Okay, good morning. Let's get started. Thanks everyone for coming. Last couple of lectures, we've delved a little bit in depth in two particular individuals associated with the Haskalah. One, of course, being Moses Mendelssohn. We'll come back to him a little bit here. But we explored a little bit some of his writings and to understand, trying to understand a little bit where his proclivities are. Was he more of a religious man? Was he more of a philosopher? When it comes to his writings, it's, as I tried to point out, it's kind of difficult. It's kind of difficult to say that he was as bifurcated as some have tried to make him out to be. And then in the last lecture, we talked a little bit about Hertz Homburg and some of his educational initiatives and the book that he wrote that became sort of a standard textbook when it came to the point where Jewish kids had to begin receiving secular education. They weren't just learning Gemara anymore. So he wrote a textbook that was meant to lay out Jewish theological principles and moral principles. One of his chidushim, the moral principles, was that he expanded what Musar was. So not just, you know, standard Musar book, but also talking about one's relationship to the state, which was a little bit of a chidush that arises out of toleration. So what I want to do for this last one, as with many things, we could talk about the Haskalah for a whole year. We could really delve in depth. But I thought it'd be worthwhile just to kind of take a bird's eye view to whatever extent possible, and even this will be a little bit incomplete in the sense, to see from the perspective of Orthodox Judaism, where was it the Haskalah worked and where does it not? The Jewish press published a whole series by a woman named Peggy Grunfeld. I think she's a sounds like she's a history teacher in Detroit. I don't know where she teaches. I don't think she teaches on the college level. I imagine it's on the high school level. She did a whole series on the Haskalah. In her first article, she contrasts medieval Jews with post-Enlightenment Jews. And this is a trend I think we can see at many points throughout Jewish history where sometimes it feels like that the more we were persecuted, the more we were able to commit to faith. So in the medieval era, and it could be that this case could be overstated a little bit, but on the whole, feels like in the medieval era, especially in Ashkenaz, medieval Jewry on the whole remained very committed to traditional. You didn't have so many trends of people choosing to go outside the fold. Your option was either traditional Judaism or conversion. So there were points where people had to make that choice. But traditional Judaism itself and the Jewish establishment itself remained very committed to halacha and that approach to life and that approach to learning. So, you know, I don't want to overstate the case and say that that nobody was creative or experimented or tried to do something off the beaten path. But on the whole, that seems to resonate. Whereas obviously the Enlightenment wouldn't have been such a big deal if it didn't create something new. So obviously there's something new that the Enlightenment created. It arises out of toleration. And with increasing tolerations, it seems like there's also increasing attrition. That with increasing toleration, so more people were able to learn different ideas, join different professions, be more integrated with society. That obviously can lead to greater, not just acculturation, but assimilation and even the creation of more sects. So question that one can ask about that Haskalah was, did more open doors lead to greater assimilation? So let's take a step back for a second The hospital law, in some ways, was actually, as much as it seems to be this overshadowing moment of Jewish history, really was just a moment. Historians date the hospital law from being around 1770 to 1810 or something of the like. And that's not necessarily about the ideas of the hospital law, but when we talk about the hospital law as a movement. So, for example, let's just say for a second that even when we talk about Moses Mendelssohn, so people often attribute him with being the father of the hospital law, but the Israeli historian Shmuel Feiner says that that's not necessarily an accurate portrayal. He might have given light to many of the ideas of the Haskalah, might have paved the way for the Maskilim, and many of the people who were considered Maskilim were his students on some level, but Mendelssohn was at most sort of an ideological figure and a figurehead. But he did not actively create any institutions that gave way to the Haskalah, whereas as a student named Isaac Yukel was one who created a journal that Maskilim participated in and a society called Chevrat Dovrei Lashon. He was instrumental creating those institutions, and there were a limited number of people who participated in these kinds of initiatives that gave the Haskalah like the actual sense of being institutionalized in an actual movement. And that sense of the Haskalah was actually very short-lived. It didn't. Mendelssohn died in 1786. Haskalah doesn't, you know, again, noting that he himself was not necessarily involved in the particulars of a movement of the Haskalah, but even then it didn't really live long beyond him. So where did it go right and where did it go wrong? So interesting, first of all, to note that I don't know for 100% certainty that this was what the Maskilim were getting at, but there's a pasuk in Daniel. It says, "Maskilim yashiru kizoa harakia, the knowledgeable will be radiant like the bright expanse of the sky." So supposedly that's where the word maskil or maskilim comes from. It comes from this pasuk in Daniel. And it's not just a random word that appears here, but this idea that that maskilim are shedding light, which goes very well with what we call the Enlightenment. It's not just that the word maskil would mean sort of somebody who's a scholar, somebody who's knowledgeable, but the idea that they're also shedding light. Context of a pasuk, it could, you know, if you were to use the word maskil anywhere else, you know, the word maskil appears in other places in Tanakh and in rabbinic literature, very likely would refer to somebody who's a Torah scholar. But here can be, obviously was easy to co-opt into the agenda of the Maskilim. So the Haskalah generally has a very bad name among Orthodox Jews. It's actually interesting. Dr. Zev Aleph and Menachem Butler, in an article in the Lehrer House, talk about Mendelssohn's fate in Jewish thought. And in some ways, Mendelssohn didn't really belong anywhere, because some people associate Mendelssohn with being sort of the founder of Reform Judaism, which is factually false. It's inaccurate both because Reform Judaism didn't exist yet at the time. It might have, Reform Judaism probably couldn't have happened without the Haskalah, but didn't really exist yet. And Mendelssohn was also too traditional for the Reform. So the Reform might have liked some of his proclivities for philosophy and going beyond the traditional canon of Jewish learning, but in terms of practice, he was probably too traditional for Reform. So there's that distance there, and for obvious reasons, the Orthodox in many cases wanted to distance themselves from Mendelssohn. But I think it's important to point out that on the surface, when it comes to Haskalah, anybody who considers himself considers themselves a modern Orthodox Jew or affiliates with anything related to modern Orthodox Judaism, it's very difficult to complain about the Haskalah, because what the Haskalah really was in its inception was study of philosophy, which Rav Soloveitchik himself did. So that has to be taken into account. And as I'll explain a little more, a lot of the Haskalah was about educational reform and introducing not just secular studies, but not just philosophy in the loftiest sense, but even just regular secular studies, being able to be conversant in language and knowing history and sciences and the like. And that's something that we take for granted today. So the question really has to be asked, what was so bad about the Haskalah? And of course, we speak English today. We don't speak Yiddish. We use science all the time. We believe in speaking in a grammatically correct fashion. So a lot of those things were very surface-level features of the Haskalah that's hard to complain about. There were, as many opponents there were the Haskalah at the outset, there were also those who weren't so against. We'll get into some of the opponents in a second, but as I mentioned over the past couple times, there were respected Chashuv rabbis who endorsed or lightly endorsed certain projects that go back to the Haskalah. So last time we talked about Hertz Homburg's work, Imri Shefer, his educational textbook. So that was endorsed by Rabbi Mordechai Bennett. And when it came to Mendelssohn's commentary on the Torah, the Biur, so Rabbi Chaska Landau, the noted Yehuda, wasn't such a fan of it, but his children subscribed to it. Like you didn't just go into Barnes and Noble or Z Berman's and buy, but you had to be a subscriber to a book in order to pay it pay for it and receive it. So Rabbi Chaska Landau's children were involved in that. I don't think Rabbi Akiva Eger himself was a subscriber. Maybe one of his children, but it could have been him himself also. So the distinction was not necessarily, it wasn't even in its earliest inception, it's not like everybody was totally against the Haskalah. Look a little bit later in time. So I gave a screenshot a little bit of an article by Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. He's the author of the Ketav Kabbalah, which is a commentary on Chumash. This is the second source. So what Professor Edward Breuer notes in this article basically was that, first of all, Rabbi Mecklenburg quoted Maskilim in his parish, but he also notes that they shared similar concerns of we often make this distinction in exegesis between pshat and drash, that there's the plain meaning of the text and drash as a separate layer. And Rabbi Mecklenburg wanted to demonstrate that that even midrashim and Talmudic explanations of the Torah were often informed by a desire for pshuto shel mikra, however one wanted to define that. Maybe at some other point I'll talk about what pshuto shel mikra has meant over the centuries. It meant very different things. But he notes in this article how Rabbi Mecklenburg was motivated by similar concerns by Maskilim, and he quoted them. He was interesting because he lived sort of on the border of Prussia towards the east, so he still had the Maskilic influence, but also was very influenced by the Vilna Gaon and Lithuanian style, so he was kind of that bridge between those two. But anyway, the Ksav Kabbalah is a very mainstream, it's considered to be a mainstream parish on the Torah. So so in the 19th century, we see that that Maskilim had an influence even on traditional individuals. So on a very basic level, it seems like certain things that motivated Maskilim very well could motivate us and motivated traditional Jews in the past. But nonetheless, the scholar has a very bad rep. So why is that? What it really comes down to, we can sort of distinguish between two types of Maskilim. And again, a lot of these people are considered disciples of Mendelssohn. They didn't necessarily all sit around Mendelssohn's house at the same time the way some people have portrayed, but people who were influenced by them. So there, in some ways, we can kind of distinguish between two types. There were the more traditional ones, and then there were the ones who really went the other direction. When it comes to the opposition to some of the more traditional Maskilim and some of their initiatives, essentially boils down to was that the rabbinic establishment perceived a very real threat to them. Now, one could argue that there were a lot of other threats at that time too. On some level, Hasidus was considered a threat not so far from the time of Mendelssohn. That was a different kind of threat. Shabtai Tzvi was a threat at the time, and Sabbatianism would plague European Jewry for some time all throughout the Haskalah. And there's certainly outright kafira. But as I noted, that it doesn't seem like when we look at Mendelssohn, when we look at Hertz Hamburg, and we'll look at another individual, Naftali Hertz Feisal or Wesley. So their heresy is not necessarily as apparent. So when it comes to Mendelssohn, it's not even clear that he was the leader of the Haskalah. Could also question his influence a little bit after over time. Rabbi Victor Miller tried saying that if you compare the Beor to the Prima Gadim, okay, commentary on Shulchan Aruch. So the Prima Gadim is found on far more bookshelves than the Beor. So that itself might be true today. It's almost impossible to find a copy of the Beor today. I have to, any time I've had to look at it, I've had to go to the YU library and it's one of those things that's like on reserve. You can only use it inside the library. So Beor is not really to be found anywhere today. Even not just the German translation part, even the commentary part. At the time, as we see with the Ksav Kabbalah, people really did seem to have the Beor. But there is a sense that, first of all, when it comes to Mendelssohn, his case might be overstated. So why did people doubt him? So again, for some of this, I'm not necessarily just relying on academic historical sources, but I'm interested in what mainstream Orthodox Jews have thought. So, an individual named Rabbi Shmuel Arendt, who's a reputed lecturer, so he's quoted as saying, much of what Mendelssohn wrote is in accordance with Jewish thought. Okay, so when you look at what he wrote, it's hard to say that anything in particular was heretical. There's some things that maybe were questionable, but nothing too horrible. But there's something inherent in Jewish thinking that is missing in Mendelssohn's writing. So when it comes to the Beor, I'm not sure if I entirely see that. When you look at Jerusalem, which was his philosophical magnum opus. Granted, it might have been. It could be. You could argue that it was oriented towards not necessarily a Jewish audience, but I see the point there a little more when it comes to Jerusalem. That Mendelssohn's in Jerusalem, Mendelssohn's trying to argue that Judaism really doesn't believe in religious coercion and the like. And you get the sense there that he's very much driven by a Western sense of tolerance and Western approaches to philosophy, but again, while I don't see anything in there that's necessarily entirely antithetical to traditional Jewish belief, but it doesn't feel Jewish. And you got the sense also, not just in his writing, but also in the sense of like what, when we think about what the Maskilim were all together. So Mendelssohn's home was not a Beis Medrash. It wasn't. So if you want to compare it to Rav Soloveitchik, for example, Rav Soloveitchik certainly conversant in philosophy, had a doctorate in philosophy, so he was a genius in the area. And yet, if a Jew were to spend a lot of time with him, you'd be talking in Gemara and Divrei Torah. You don't get the sense from going to, from reading about Mendelssohn's salon and the people who associate with him, that even if they knew a lot of Gemara, even if they were Jewishly knowledgeable and learned, you don't really get the sense that it was a Beis Medrash, that was a place that was of spiritual growth and the like. And that's where I kind of see Rabbi Aaron's point here, is that that could be one thing to say that there wasn't anything heretical, but it's another thing to say of whether was this going to be the path forth for traditional Judaism, was this going to raise generations of committed, devout Torah scholars. So that's one. That's one argument. And the other argument that comes up, if you look, go to page 4 and 5, where Rabbi Beryl Wein writes, this is he's written about this in a couple of different places, but where I got this from, I was actually lucky that last night I was looking at my bookshelf and I remembered to look at this book. So he has a book on trends in Jewish history. So he writes, Moses Mendelssohn was a champion. I'm on page four, towards the middle. Moses Mendelssohn was a champion of this wave of a strong push for maximum German acculturation. However, this type of acculturation almost immediately led to assimilation and conversion to Christianity. Most of Mendelssohn's own children converted, and his descendants in the next generation were almost uniformly all Christian. So when people talk about Mendelssohn's legacy, that's definitely something at least in when people talk about his legacy in the negative, that's definitely something that comes up a lot, that at the end of the day, and granted, many Torah scholars have had children who've gone on a different path, so you can't necessarily look at one's own children as proof one way or another. I think that'd be quite dangerous. But at the same time, when one looks at the combination of his disciples and his descendants, perhaps, so there's something there that seems to, even if he himself maintained a traditional bent, it seems like that something went wrong there. And he writes this again on page 5. The Jewish Enlightenment. This is all Rabbi Beryl Wein. I'm blanking on the exact title, but it's a recent book on trends in Jewish history.
Was he alive, Mendelssohn, when his children?
It's a good question. I don't know. His grandson was the composer Felix Mendelssohn. I don't know.
Couldn't have been too happy.
No, but that'd be an interesting.
Right, but at the same time, you know. So, on one hand, might not have been happy. On the other hand, it's a new world, and it's a tolerant world, and you know, Mendelssohn himself was begged to convert to Christianity. That's kind of like his defense, whatever he wrote in defense of Judaism was often because he was said, so you're so enlightened, come convert to Christianity. But at the same time, he wasn't about to denounce Christianity as being entirely wrong. But he felt like He felt like that Judaism had its place also. So on page 5, he write, in the packet, he writes, the Jewish Enlightenment is usually ascribed in its beginnings to the singular personage of Moses Mendelssohn, which again, we've said, you know, that can be a little bit overstated. Mendelssohn himself was an observant Jew and corresponded with many of the great rabbinic scholars of his time, which, by the way, is true. He had a lot of correspondence with Rav Yaakov Emden. However, his philosophy and view of the Bible was heavily influenced by critical Enlightenment attitudes towards the holiness and divinity of the Bible, and the rational criticism and agnosticism towards traditional religious and folk beliefs. And thus his views and very personality were the source of continuing controversy over his place in the traditional Jewish world. A wave of conversions to Christianity began to sweep German Jews with the fall of ghetto walls. Many Jews felt that conversion was the only way to really get ahead in the new environment of emancipation and enlightenment. So as previously mentioned, four of Mendelssohn's own children converted to Christianity, and all of his grandchildren, including the famous composer Felix Mendelssohn, were Christians. The sad state of his descendants weighed heavily against Mendelssohn himself and later generations in the eyes of the traditional Jewish community. Many have attempted to rehabilitate him, but in the Orthodox Jewish world today, he has few defenders outside of academia. Though I think, you know, again, whether it's fair or not to judge Mendelssohn based on what his children and descendants had to do, what Rabbi Wein is writing is definitely reflective of the way many people perceive Mendelssohn. It also could be at the time, you know, again, people did convert to Christianity over centuries, but you know, there's a difference in doing it when you're being expelled or you're being slaughtered versus when your motive is to do it to become more enlightened, to become more part of society. And that part of it, I guess, could be argued was a little bit new. And again, I don't necessarily. I hate to say that children's deeds are the fault of parents. He could have done everything right, but it also could be that that they got the sense from their home that, you know, Judaism was something that their father was interested in intellectually, something that he was traditional. But you know, so okay, so our father was traditional. You know, this is what he was used to. We're kind of crossing that bridge into the new world a little bit. Meanwhile, while there were some scholars who didn't have a problem with some Talmidei Chachamim didn't have a problem with Mendelssohn, Chasam Sofer, quoting a Gemara, this is the source for on page 2. The Gemara in Shabbos says, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Im Talmud Chacham Nokem v'Noter K'nachash Hu Chagrehu Amonecha. Even if a Torah scholar is as vengeful and begrudging as a snake, wrap him around your waist, tightly around your waist, keep him close because you will benefit from his Torah. Imam Ha'aretz Hu Chasid Alta Dor B'Shkunato. On the other hand, even if an Am Ha'aretz is righteous, do not dwell in his neighborhood, as his righteousness does not compensate for the fact that he's ignorant. So in his ethical will given to his children, the Chasam Sofer writes, do not live in their vicinity and do not associate with them at all, and never occupy yourselves with the writings of Rav Moshe of Dessau. Then your foot will not stumble. So this reference here, in some ways it would be fitting if it's the other way, if you're referring to Mendelssohn, that you know, if Talmud Chacham is not pious, you know, I would have seen that because it wasn't Am Ha'aretz. I would have thought that his intellect would probably outweigh the perception of piety at the least. That's the sense we get about the Chasam Sofer. There's another, yeah, go ahead.
This comment seems to me there's a very big debate going on when you have rabbis who are, let's say, involved in scandals, and the question is, do we still learn the Torah? You know,
right.
Seems to support that you still should. So a lot of people would seem to go the opposite direction. It's involved in very unattractive activities that you should not. And the Torah just seems to say that you should.
Right, right. And here it's very complicated because again it's hard to say that Mendelssohn himself did anything problematic, but if you believe that what he started was problematic. So, you know, the more, I don't know how to phrase this, but like the more, you know, liberal of an Orthodox Jew one might be, one might just say, well, he had good Torah, and we should learn it. And others who were probably more guarded about traditionalism probably said, you know, said stay away, you know, don't come near with the 10-foot pole because you know, you just don't know where this is leading. And that's the sense that you get.
They didn't have the concept of modern Orthodoxy. I guess if
correct.
They would have had it, a lot of these people wouldn't have converted to Christianity because they went from one extreme to the other.
Right. Right. So yeah, so that's an interesting point that's what I said at the beginning was that in some, you know, as we're talking about this, I think, you know, even though sort of the traditional Orthodox trope has been that the Haskalah was bad and Mendelssohn was bad, I think for those who identify as modern Orthodox today, that's almost a little more difficult to justify because when we look at a lot of what certain Maskilim wrote and the way they lived their life and what they advocated for, it's not so different than what we believe in.
I don't know about that because what Rabbi Wise said that this allowed them to have higher access to the upper echelons of society. And would that necessarily, in that day and age, would be modern Orthodox and still... You know, keeping kosher and observing Shabbos, would that still at that point, right, given them the echelons, the access to the upper echelons of society?
Are you saying they must have had to abandon something in order to get up there? It could be. I mean, Mendelssohn was able to balance it. He remained observant his whole life, and people respected him. But it could be that other people weren't going to be able to pull that up. Right. So, but that still sort of proves your point, Herb, that, you know, could be that if there was more of a framework for that, then, you know, people wouldn't have had to choose.
Well,
so,
didn't reform start like that? They wanted to give a framework, and then so people shouldn't convert?
Yeah, so reform starts to involve, you know, making actual changes to the practice of Judaism, whereas the Haskalah was more of an intellectual approach. So, another figure who's very interesting in this discussion is an individual named Naftali Hertz Vesey. He wrote a pamphlet, and some say that some really credit him with the beginning of the Haskalah in a certain sense, not in terms of its institutions, but he really breaks the ground for some of the advocacy of ideas. He wrote a pamphlet called the Yirei Shalom Ve'emet, which is a little bit ironic in a sense. I guess the idea of Shalom Ve'emet was that I'm coming to you peacefully with ideas I believe are true, but ignited a whole lot of controversy. Again, if you were to, I didn't provide so many excerpts of it, but if you were to look at it, you'd probably say that there's nothing that's so crazy about it. He basically was saying that it's time for Jewish children to learn secular studies, that Gemara isn't everything, that it's important to be worldly. He talks about Torah Adam versus Torah Adam versus Torah Elohim. So there's there's Torah Elohim, you know, refers to Torah as we know it, but Torah Adam is the way we interact with people. In order to interact with people and to be accepted in society, so we have to be conversant we have to be able to speak the language, to speak it properly, to know proper grammar, to be aware of the sciences, and the
Torah
like.
Umata.
Yeah. So what he was kind of advocating was Torah Umata.
When did he live?
This is the late 18th century. He's a close student of Mendelssohn, and he was one of the authors of he authored the Vayikra section of the Biur, which was seen as Mendelssohn's project, but he was the one who actually wrote the commentary on Vayikra. So he writes, this is source 5, there's one people in the world alone who are not sufficiently concerned with human knowledge and who have neglected the public institution of their youth and the laws of etiquette, the sciences, and the arts. We, the children of Israel, who are dispersed through all of Europe and who live in most of its states, have turned our back on these studies. Many among Israel are men of intelligence and great understanding, and many are also men of faith and piety. But from childhood, their exclusive preoccupation has been God's laws and teachings. They have not heard or studied human knowledge, right, Torah Adah. Many of them do not even know how to read or write their native language. So he's saying it's time to change the way we learn. So, again, was education reform really the greatest threat? So the truth is that most rabbis would have agreed that this wasn't such a bad thing. Okay, we're going to see in a second. Noda Behuda lashed out against him. There were two rabbis who spent their Shabbos HaGadol drasha bashing him. One of them was a Noda Behuda. But the Noda Behuda didn't necessarily think that some secular studies was a bad thing. He wasn't entirely against it. But here's what he writes, source 6. An evil man has arisen from our own people. Okay? Tell what he thinks of him already. And brazenly asserted that the Torah is not all important and that etiquette is more vital than the Torah. Now, as to the substance of the matter, the value of etiquette and grammatical knowledge, I too esteem these things. Okay, he says that. The government has done a great favor in deciding to teach our children to speak German correctly. Even in the time of the last prophets, the king commanded that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah be taught the language of the Chaldeans. But there's obviously a lot of animosity, and he says no Jew will welcome him or invite him into his home, that each one fearing divine retribution will avoid any contact with his evil heretic, and anyone despising and rebuffing him will be rewarded with heavenly blessing. Pamphlet in itself, a denial of Torah, a mockery of the written and oral law, reflects the view that they are of no value or benefit. So one thing that probably got some of these rabbis very ired was that he quoted a medrash. Leslie quoted a medrash where he says, "A Talmid Chacham who lacks knowledge, a carcass is better than he." Okay, it's a direct quote from a medrash. A Talmid Chacham who lacks knowledge, a carcass is better than he. Nevela. I don't remember if the word was nevela or trefa in this case, but it's not just. But again, that's where sort of the Shalom Ve'emes things becomes a little bit ironic. He definitely said what he thought, but in certain places, Vesely himself was not entirely conciliatory, and he probably could have made his point without that jab to Gedolei Torah, who were steeped in Gemara. I know of a story when Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner was paid a shiva call, and I think after his wife died, and somebody came and just like talked a lot, but said a lot of insensitive things, and Rav Huttner quoted this medrash to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that this person doesn't have das, Talmid Chacham who doesn't have das, a carcass is better than he. So you don't have to read this medrash and say that somebody who doesn't know secular studies is doesn't necessarily have to be read that way, but that's the way Vesely chose to quote it. Get back to in a second to what also probably would have ired some of the rabbis, but there's another rabbi named Rabbi David ben Nasan Tevela of Lisa. He was the chief rabbi of Lisa. So he also in the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha says, we speak of an act of a sycophant, an evil man, a man poor in understanding, the most mediocre of mediocre men. This man, Hertz Vesely of Berlin, has addressed an epistle to those of the house of Israel who dwell in the land of his majesty, the emperor. This epistle, called Words of Peace and Truth, makes one's heart heavy. It consists of 8 chapters of bootlicking. Our children shall study the sciences as an adornment. However, the foundations of their education will be in accordance with the command of our ancient sages of the Talmud. So here, the issue you got into is not, again, not, this isn't saying that that in Brooklyn that no child should ever pick up a secular book. That's not what this is. This is, here they're acknowledging that there might be some value at the end of the day to learning the sciences and language and the like, but it's not Torah Umada, but it's Torah in Derech Eretz, it's Torah in Parnassa, it's doing what you need to do in order to be able to function in society, but the emphasis should be on Talmud. And the tone of Bess's letter it definitely denigrates Gemara learning probably beyond what was comfortable for the establishment Rabbanim. So then he writes, how did he dare, this man lacking in all sublime wisdom, other than the fundamentals of Hebrew language, the literal meaning of the Bible, and a rudimentary knowledge of scriptures and commentaries, He has no part or share in the profundities of the Talmud, the early commentaries of the Oral Torah. How does he have the audacity to say, I shall offer them counsel? How does this man, who does not possess any of the foundations of wisdom, come forth to teach us the proper curriculum to instruct this people in the ways of God and the deeds they must do? The weak will, I am strong, and the blind will say, walk at my feet, I will show you the way. So here you get to another issue, which could in some ways be called Das Torah, but I think it's not even Das Torah at its extreme. But here's what gets the rabbis angry a little bit, is that Wesley was not a rabbi of standing. He's coming to challenge a rabbinate. So it would have been one thing to get together with the Barnum community and put out a proposal. Again, it seems like a lot of them were in favor of it. But here's an example, and these kinds of examples we can still find up until this very day, where things that on the surface may not seem so offensive, if they're done in a way that's meant to undermine the rabbinate, is going to drive the rabbis a little bit crazy. If you look at source 8, Rabbi Avi Shafran, who's the spokesman, I don't think he was yet the spokesman for the Aguda, now he is. By the time he wrote for the Jewish Observer, and by the way, I'll note that Rabbi Shafran, I've heard him say himself, is a bit of a proponent of Torah Derech Eretz, which is not necessarily true of everybody affiliated with the Aguda at this point. This is a fascinating article because he looks at particularly Mendelssohn, but again, I think this applies really to Askelah in general. And he says, you know, when you look at Mendelssohn, there might not be so much about him per se that was so offensive. So where did he go wrong? And he says, it is my thesis that Mendelssohn's mistake can be seen as nothing more than varied manifestations of one central pervasive theme, a lack of regard for the opinions of Torah scholars and the Gedolim of his time. This is so the hindsight of history, the image of the fate of Mendelssohn's family and entourage can benefit us with a timely incident and momentous lesson. He was not a bad Jew in any clear way. He was just convinced that he knew better than those who were unchallenged Torah giants of his time as to what response was required of Judaism to those times. So imagine many a modern Orthodox reader who sees this would probably say, I'm not a Das Torah person. But in the context of what Wesley wrote, it actually, you can see what the emerging pattern was that people who are not necessarily, Mendelssohn, I get the sense, was probably more conversant in Talmud and Halacha than Wesley was, but you see that there's this sort of butting heads between the Maskilim who thought that they, you know, were the enlightened ones and they have the path forward, and they're going up directly against the rabbis of the time, and that's not going to go well. Okay, Rabbi David of Lisa continues in source 9, I deplore the act of this man, a hypocrite and evildoer, a boor, the worst kind of layman by the name of Hertz Wesley from Berlin. Proud and haughty is this enemy of the Jew who is a threat to our very lives. He's excommunicated, banned, and cursed with the blowing of the shofar and the extinguishing of candles, for he is accursed and damned, cut off from the congregation of Israel. My heart shall moan like a harp. Oh, that my head were waters, and I might weep day and night for the daughter of my... copy and paste that, but it doesn't seem to make sense. What that means. Right, but I don't know what the word them of my them in means.
Where's Lisa? Sounds like Italian.
You know, it could have been.
What does he have to do with Germany?
Well, because all this spreads around, right? There was the Edict of Tolerance. Edict of Tolerance was issued in 1782, so that wasn't just Berlin. That's also getting into Austria, and this is spreading all throughout Europe. This is not just at this point Germany. That's a good point. Yeah.
Why are they focusing on Wesley instead of Mendelssohn?
Because again, Mendelssohn was like kind of like he was. He was a philosopher in the Ivory Tower, but he wasn't actively promoting any initiatives per se. This guy Wesley is getting up and saying, "I'm going to change the face of Jewish education," and the rabbis are kind of saying, "You know, not so fast. Who are you to do it?" So between the tone and again this idea that that this idea that, you know, that it's not just that we're adding secular studies, but they're kind of downplaying the importance of traditional Jewish learning. So it's one thing to, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, we'll have a little bit of secular studies, but it's another thing to, which is interesting. You know, it's interesting. You know, the concerns are in some ways are sort of well founded. I am concerned today in modern Orthodox schools that with the we have a very rigorous dual curriculum, and yet it's very hard to, if you learn Gemara for 2 hours a week total, so that's not necessarily turning one into a Talmud Chacham, which is what these rabbis were legitimately concerned about, that this would be the end of Torah scholarship.
Was Wesley himself a
So I don't know what his Gemara learning was like. Mendelssohn, I would say was, they're portraying Wesley as not being. He was definitely knowledgeable in many areas of Judaism. Whether he was a Gemara scholar, not so clear to me. And again, what Wesley was preaching was not necessarily, you know, the idea was, well, this is how you'll remain Jewish but also be part of secular society. This wasn't, how am I going to bring people to greater Yerushalayim at the same time as, so that's something that, you know, perhaps, you know, separates, you know, other individuals in modern Orthodoxy who might promote the very same kind of curriculum and ideas, that you can't just learn Gemara all day, but at the same time, I would hope that in most yeshivas they still see strict Torah observance in Yerushalayim as something of value.
In Poland,
okay. The last of the traditional Muskim that I'll touch on, and then I'll quickly talk about those who strayed, was Hertz Hamburg. So again, I know the last lecture we spent a lot of time talking about him. He wrote a very traditional textbook, but there were indications that he spoke badly about the rabbis. In source 10, he says, the Jews are conceited ad nauseam and proclaim themselves the chosen people. The rabbis cannot change and are therefore hopeless and should be dismissed. The yeshivas must be closed down and Hebrew studies discontinued. So I don't know if this is a true quote. Doesn't
to me.
Right. I don't know where this quote came from. It was attributed to him. There was a set, you know, there were people who said once that they saw Hertz Hamburg, eating pig on Yom Kippur or something like that. But it was quoted on one particular academic source where, you know, the story was not so easily verified. So Hamburg has been vilified a little bit. But if what he said is true, then that's obviously problematic. But overall, when you look even at the most traditional Maskilim, so there's questions of whether they manipulated texts to support their agenda. You know, do they know sources but have a more sinister motive? And Professor Edward Breuer writes, some Orthodox rabbis open to educational reform, but were more devoted to preserving rabbinic norms than even the most traditional Maskim. And that's sort of where this divide ends up coming. Or to quote Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger in source 11, once a community appointed a learned and pious Rav who preached in German. Next, they will likely hire a weak and unlearned German-speaking Rav, and eventually they will simply employ a Gentile. So
yeah, that's what they said when rabbis switched from Yiddish to English.
Right. So that was kind of where a lot of this came from, was that, you know, it's one thing to be supportive of some educational reform, but the lengths to which Maskilim were advocating it, they were concerned that even if the ones in that generation weren't so bad, down the line, it would lead to something. There were, as I said, there were other Maskilim who were definitely not as innocent. There was an individual named David Friedlander. He writes here, 3,000 years after the granting of the Torah, these rabbis are still busy pondering the question whether, on conception of less than a morsel, one must recite the grace after meals or not. In short, we do not know any more what religion is and what is virtue. The natural consequence of all this must be, my hairs bristle at the thought of it, that our sons will first abandon Judaism, then convert to Christianity. I have found only one possible solution, to throw off the heavy yoke of our own rabbis and communal leaders. Only if we are free, neither afraid of the ruling party nor intimidated by the threat of excommunication and the refusal of burial rites will be possible to raise Israel's prestige, our Torah, and the teachings of Moses from the dust. The commandments have turned us into foreigners in the everyday circle of life. The scrupulous observance of meaningless customs have embarrassed us, often causing us to feel discomfort in the company of persons of a different religion, even the company of servants. So, Friedlander, to say the least, so you just want to say that the more traditional masculine kind of maybe felt this way, but maybe concealed it a little more. Friedlander was not shy about the fact that he was anti-rabbinic Judaism. And P.S., he eventually, at some point, wanted to have what was called a dry baptism, where he would convert to Christianity without accepting Jesus. So as much as he said, you know, that he's worried that our sons will first abandon Judaism and then convert to Christianity, about 7 years later, he did the same thing himself. He says that, I didn't put this here, but he said at some point, the freedom the Jews enjoyed would be expanded, they would no longer study Talmud, there would be no more yeshiva, the halacha would be forgotten, the rabbis would no longer have any authority. In Berlin, there are hardly any, So you have people like Friedlander who were more of that bent, who wanted to demolish rabbinic Judaism and the rabbis. You know, getting rid of rabbinic Judaism, I couldn't find this, but I remember seeing when I was in college that there were sources where the Maasef, where they would talk, when they talked about tefillin, they would call them Totafot, or Rosh Hashanah would be referred to Yom HaZikaron, and that is because tefillin is a rabbinic term, Rosh Hashanah is a rabbinic term, in the Torah, Shebichtav, it is Yom HaZikaron, Totafot. So that shows sort of a preference to Tanakh over Talmud, and even to the point where those terms were the accepted terms. So to lead us to a little bit of a conclusion, Shmuel Feiner, one of the great scholars of the Haskalah, has written some of the most authoritative and comprehensive books on it. He says that the Haskalah was certainly a revolution. On the one hand, it started out, again, when you talk about the actual Haskalah, think about that, you had to be fairly elite to actually be part of the Haskalah. It's one thing to advocate the educational reforms, but to be a maskil, you had to be somewhat of elite, and certainly the number of maskilim paled to what you would find in Chassidus. Most maskilim, he says, didn't want to destroy Judaism per se, but they wanted to revitalize, but that did involve changing parts of Judaism that obviously the traditional rabbinate was not in favor of. He calls it, it does become sort of a secular revolution because it's meant to weaken rabbinic power. He writes this in source 13, from this historic moment, separation between the Orthodox leadership and the secular intellectual was determined. Even though the maskil may have continued to observe the religious norms in his personal life and as a member of the community, his public literary life, he drew his authority and ideas from his new reading of all aspects of Jewish tradition, from his analysis of reality and his rational judgment. What we sort of see from all this is that a lot of what went wrong with Haskalah, again, putting aside Friedlander and other maskilim who either converted Christianity or totally denounced the rabbis, was that the content of a lot of initiatives that were advocated, or even their own writing on Judaism itself, might not be seen as controversial. What happens when you look at it in context, though, is that there definitely was a sense of an attempt to weaken rabbinic power, which, at the risk of sounding to be on a totally different extreme, there's something to be said for the fact that can be dangerous, and it's something that, even today, something I would be concerned about. And a lot of this is about process. So one of the biggest proponents of Torah Mada in the last generation was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and even he writes in one of his articles that in order to have that kind of hashkafa, you still need a Gadol Yisrael to endorse it. So for him, that was Rav Soloveitchik. But Maskilim took sort of a different and said, this is what's right, and this is what we're going to put out to the Jewish people, and not necessarily in concert with the rabbinate. So that was certainly something that helps Meskimen butt heads with the rabbin, and probably didn't help their cause. So it seems like that, you know, where did the Haskalah go right, where did it go wrong? A lot of what the Haskalah advocated are things that, you know, we ourselves have today. But where it went wrong was the leading towards a path of assimilation. And you have to say that on some level that if you're going to weaken rabbinic authority to that extent, so where are your values coming from, and where is your life choices coming from? Is it coming from the guidance of Talmid Chachamim, or is it coming from the secular world? So a combination of weakened rabbinic authority and assimilation that led to the point in many cases of conversion to Christianity at the time seems to be where the Haskalah came wrong. So I've shared a couple of my opinions, I guess, of where I think this is relevant today, but leaves us with what to think about in 2020 as well. Okay, have a good morning.